Thank you to our presenters, Elliot and Sasha, for a wonderful presentation. We're going to move now into the Q&A portion of our seminar. We have about 50 minutes for this discussion. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the MicroLink seminar format, what we'll do is we'll take one question from here in the room. We have about 24 people here in DC. And then we'll take one question from the webinar room. We have 115 people from around the world joining us. And we'll switch back and forth. So we'll start with here in the room. I'm going to ask that you say your name and your organization. Thank you.
Hi, Dan Norell from World Vision. My question is around the food security indicators that you use, especially for Uganda, but perhaps for the other projects. Did you look at stunting? Was it food diversity scores? What were you looking at? And after you made those changes, what needles moved on the indicators? So that would be helpful.
I am not the health and nutrition person, so I don't know those indicators, but we've got a midterm evaluation I can give you. I know it had some of the classic, we use some of the classic food for peace indicators. I don't know if stunting was it. I'm guessing stunting was in there. And I think, so the midterm evaluation was done basically a year ago, and we've been shifting approaches. So my guess is we have probably not seen significant changes yet, but hopefully in the next year, but I can get you more details on this.
Okay, so we'll switch to the webinar.
Great. So there was a question on how does Mercy Corps, as a predominantly humanitarian and food for peace development partner, really work on building long-term transformative capacity? There was a short response by Carrie Byrne, the chief of party of our PRIME project in Ethiopia, saying that PRIME is an example of where we've worked on a major investment fund with private equity groups and working at the trader processor level. But Elliot and Sasha, other examples, Elliot, of how aid agencies essentially can work on a transformative capacity level?
That's a great question. It's something that I think Mercy Corps and others tend to struggle with because it really scales up the types of interventions that we need to be working on. I think a good example of a place that we're, just to ground it in a particular place, of where Mercy Corps is trying to build transformative capacity is through one of our programs called ACER and the Asian Cities Climate Change Resilience Network that's funded by Rockefeller. The reason I bring this up is because in this work takes place in sort of the second cities of Jakarta, really large urban spaces. And the way it's operating is through bringing stakeholders across multiple agencies together to be able to plan for the impacts of climate change and things like sea level rise. You know, this is an approach where it's not like Mercy Corps is going out, running an assessment on our own, and then developing some sort of interventions that we're then implementing on our own or with a small set of partners. We're really focusing on building the capacity of the city government, the various agencies that manage that government, and have direct influence over the well-being of the inhabitants of that city to be able to flexibly adapt and plan for and prepare for different shocks and stresses related to climate and other things. So I think that that's an example of how transformative capacity can be built, by building the capacity of institutions, the policies, and the policies that they write and enforce.
All right, thank you. And we'll take one from the room.
Hi, Laura Meisner from USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. So you brought up some of the maybe inherent issues around the resilience approach and the market systems approach in terms of timeframes. Another one I think that we've run into with some of our own work is also around the issue of subsidies and just kind of the approach, because I think you see a lot of the quote-unquote resilience work that tends to get funded is sort of the heavy, you know, food for work type stuff, very heavily subsidized issues, and we've run into it trying to do BRR and really talk folks out and take the long time. Is that something that you guys ran into as well, and maybe speaking to it or any sort of recommendations or issues that you've run into?
Yeah, and I definitely think that's one of the inherent tensions between market system development and resilience, is that we often run into the challenge of who are we trying to help? And market system development can look at, or one of the assumptions about people who do market system development is we work with this economically active group and we often miss the bottom layer, and that is often a population that we want to target with resilience. we tested some things in RAIN actually around using targeted subsidies to bring that bottom group of the population into the market system, and we ran into some challenges. In other places, we've done it better. And so the short conclusion, but I think this is something that needs a lot more study within our industry, is, yeah, there are ways you can do subsidies well. They are, it's hard, it's not the easy way. The blanket subsidies don't work. There are ways to do very targeted subsidies, ideally back up the chain where you're building people into the market system. But this is an inherent challenge, and yeah, there's an awful lot of use of subsidies undermining longer-term market system approaches. So we got to get better at it.
And one from the webinar?
There's a few around the question on the links to nutrition and how that's incorporated in some of the assessment and measurement. I think the underlying idea is, you know, if the links between production and better nutrition are tenuous at best. So in this case, Elliot, within a stress process, how would you go about doing that in a way that focuses on nutrition as an outcome as opposed to just say income or even food security in other forms?
So the question there is, how would an analysis process or trying to understand how systems function support nutrition as opposed to just maybe like well-being generally?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the sort of end result of nutrition, well-being, food security might not change necessarily the way that the assessment is done. It would change maybe the factors that are included or the data that we collect and the data that we analyze. So the beginning step of any strategic resilience assessment process that we do starts off with a scoping phase, as we call it, where we try to identify in the very beginning, amongst many other things, what is the development problem or situation we're trying to solve. That could be poverty, it could be malnutrition, it could be food insecurity. That sets the basis for how we understand what about social, ecological, and economic systems are contributing to that problem of, in this case, maybe a lack of nutrition. Then we would try to understand how various shocks and stresses are combining to equal that situation. So I'm not sure if that actually answers the question, John, but in terms of how within an assessment process, that's how I think we would handle it or address it.
Hi, I'm Mayada El-Zaghi with SIGA. So I want to hone in on the question that you raised at the very end, Sasha, which is about this issue of the long-term nature of these kinds of programs and the need to rethink maybe how projects are supported or funded or whatever. But I've been working with the donor community for the last 6 years, and I also noticed one thing, which is most of the funders that you mentioned were foundations, which I found curious. So is there something about bilaterals and multilaterals that you think might make this very difficult to make this shift, or what would you recommend for that particular segment, which are fundamentally the largest still funders in the world?
Not to bite the hand that feeds Mercy Corps very well. No, and a lot of the resilience work we're doing is actually funded by USAID, and I know there's a lot of new emphasis on resilience within AID. A number of our Food for Peace programs now have a resilience focus, but I do think that what we find is some of the foundations are more able to fund experimental programs. And in some cases, we can work more flexibly with them to set up time frames and expectations. I'm trying to unpack a bit why, and I'm thinking part of it, in some foundations, it's much more about a personal relationship with the grants officer, and they have a lot more leeway. So in some ways, we can go in 6 months in and shift things significantly, and it doesn't take layers of approvals and things. So yeah, I do think if in terms of experimenting in this area, some of the alternative donors may be a good way to pilot test things before we take them to large institutional donors. But the institutional donors are still very important.
just to add to that, I mean, donors like USAID and others as well are providing us with some unique opportunities to actually be able to do these types of assessments that we've been talking about off and on. You know, oftentimes we have to write a proposal with pretty strict ideas about what we're going to do, and then we learn more than a ton of new information through implementation because we didn't have the time available to actually do the scale of the analysis we'd like to do up front. What we're seeing is an increase in opportunities to have inception phases where we can, before entering an inception phase, we can broadly say, here's what we think is needed, but we're not really, we need a period of time to run some analysis and then we'll get much more specific. That's been incredibly helpful for us in terms of our resilience building efforts. And it's really been key to this approach in general.
Okay, and another one from the webinar.
Yeah, there's a good exchange here on how RAIN, the program you highlighted from Uganda, is a market systems program versus a value chain program focused on sesame. And the program director there, Maluku, came in and said, you know, you highlighted the example of the sesame production, but the program has interventions around financial services, input, sort of a broader market development program. But a follow-up question asks, what are the market system's goals? And then is asking around, you know, does the market system need to become more resilient in order to support resilience at a community or household level? So that the relationship there would be helpful for you to clarify.
Yeah, and just to reiterate what Malaku said, RAIN is a very large, comprehensive program with many facets, and I highlighted one that had a very clear resilience implication, but that's by no means all. We're doing a lot of work with inputs. We're doing a lot of work on financial services. We've brought in a number of regional buyers who are now doing contract farming. There's other elements to the program, too. But you highlighted an interesting subject of debate, which is resilience within the market system versus resilience of the population. And I think this is a really crucial point because, as Elliot highlighted, the key is resilience for whom and to what. And that is the core of what we need to be focused on. And yes, you need a resilient market system to enable that. And so there are a lot of important elements around multiple players in a market system, competition, good governance, et cetera, to make sure that that market system itself is resilient and can then enable the resilience of the people we care about. But you could develop a very resilient market system that was not getting at the resilience of the population you care about. And so you still have to understand who you care about, what their resilience is, what are the shocks and stresses they need to respond to, and how the system will support that. And if we jump too quickly to back into our comfortable market systems framework, we could miss the overall goal entirely.
Hi, my name is Diane DiBernardo. I'm a nutrition advisor in the Bureau for Food Security. And what struck me in the first example where dietary diversity may actually have declined and that the income was being used more on equipment and other things, I was curious whether you might consider taking a more gendered approach and getting more income into the hands of women, so focusing on crops that women control because they are more likely to spend their money on food and healthcare and things like that rather than equipment. But that's also not to say the equipment isn't also important.
That brings up a very good point, and this is a very complicated situation, so I won't get into all the details, and I'm obviously not the expert on RAIN, so I don't want to say anything incorrect, but we actually have a gender advisor on this program, and there is a gendered approach, and some of those issues came up in the midterm evaluation, and so we've adjusted. But one of the interesting complexities we found here is who is doing the agriculture and who controls the money. And this is also an area with some societal breakdown. It was people were shifted. They were agropastoralists for a long time because of insecurity. They were living in camps. Traditional livelihoods have broken down. And so what we found is the increase in incomes were just exacerbating issues in the household around control of money, around domestic violence, all sorts of. So yeah, there's a very complicated situation there around who's actually doing the work in agriculture, who's controlling the money, and how that is influencing household dynamics. And so we've been unpacking all of that and figuring out what the program needs to do specifically to address these issues, but it points out how complex each of these are. And it's not just a simple win-win. You've got to really understand the dynamics in every context.
Good. Another stream is around measurement and the need to, I think, raise the comfort level of implementers and donors around fuzzy concepts like market facilitation, resilience as an outcome. The question, though, is one I think is answerable, which is, how do you measure the crowding in of others into the Sesame market? And then maybe I would add there, you know, and then looking at, so what are the effects if we're doing that well?
And I think we've got some clear numbers. Yeah, we measured crowding in by, we worked with a regional buyer who came in to the area for the first time and set up a lot of contracts. But then we had other buyers come in independently because they saw the potential in the area. And what we've also seen is those players starting to interact with some of the other institutions we've been facilitating. So now GADCO, which is this agriculture buyer, has done relationships with Postbank, which we brought into the area around contract farming. So what we're seeing is nuanced relationships between the different institutions in the network that are increasing the overall sustainability. So it's the direct indicators are other players coming in without our direct involvement, but then a secondary indicator is the other relationships being built. I don't know if that sufficiently answers the question, John, but or if you have anything to add.
Paul Lindbergh. Actually, I'm working for the Australian aid section now and on a new program in Indonesia that actually, at least during the design phase, is all focused on adaptive learning.
Yeah.
And how to support new law on village governance, which will hopefully enhance the potential for rural and urban citizens to be able to have greater impact on their own livelihoods. My question is, you mentioned that the way you would scale up these micro interventions is through building capacity of government to take the lead. I'm interested in how you would do that, because taking Jakarta, I mean, Jakarta has a lot of capable people. It also has a very complex political economy. Within the political realm, between politicians and bureaucracy, and with the very heavy influence of large-scale private sector investors. So how do you address these fuzzy concepts in a political, very complex political economy in order for them to understand and begin to integrate that into their own political policy thinking?
I don't think anyone has a perfectly clear answer as to how to do that, obviously. I mean,
it's doing it in Jakarta.
Well, we're not doing it in, yeah,
we're doing it in secondary cities in Indonesia.
So I can speak to the way that program is doing it. So that ACERN program is doing it, like I said, by bringing multiple interests, multiple stakeholders together across different agencies to plan. One of the processes they're doing, and one of the ways in which they're building capacity is actually doing joint vulnerability assessments. So bringing different stakeholders into the process of understanding vulnerability and the needs in terms of building resilience was a key way for building the capacity to learn about what is, in that case, climate change adaptation or climate resilience mean for an urban area. You know, there's also a lot of learning now and a lot of discussion around not just having to bring in government, but having to bring in private interests as well, recognizing that they have huge influence over these places, not just urban areas, but rural areas as well. So I don't think it would be very wise just to focus purely on the government actors in any one place, but you'd have to bring in the private companies as well. They offer solutions as well as the ability to influence how investments are made.
Speaking, being the market systems person, I think a lot of this gets back to the underlying concept of incentives. And what are the incentives of government, community groups, private sector to engage? What we see in Indonesia is local climate effects are having significant impacts on cities, local flooding, pollution, et cetera. And so local governments are feeling the pressure from that. And what we did was help make the issues and the solutions very real through these vulnerability assessments, which then created a roadmap for how local government could address them. And so I think it's making the constraints very clear and then the incentives to address them.
Defuzzying the concept.
Okay, we've got one here around evidence gaps. So if one of the key messages is that market systems development can build resilience, but not inherently, can you talk a little bit more about, based on the learning from Nepal, Uganda, potentially elsewhere, where are the biggest gaps in terms of, I guess, what assumptions market development or economic development more broadly has around building resilience? So a few that come to mind for me would be around livelihoods diversity. That was mentioned in the chat, and evidence that I'm aware of is mixed. Financial inclusion or financial services, another one. I guess what for you all are the big knowledge gaps, and how are we working on those collectively?
Yes, certainly the obvious one is that increasing income in and of itself will fix many issues. And we know that already, that income is not enough, but it seems like in every sector we have to learn that again. And so recognizing that if you're increasing people's incomes, if you're increasing their economic participation, you may have to work on other issues as well, and both awareness, behavior change, et cetera, to deal with the other issues.
Maybe another gap might be, and this was something that was mentioned in this recent USAID report on market systems for resilience, is methods or practical ways of diversifying risk,
yeah.
Right? I mean, we can talk about diversifying livelihoods, or livelihood strategies, diversifying crops being planted, things like that, but it's only as good as the risk that we're diversifying as well. So methods for not only identifying what those risks are across systems is good, but then we have to come up with more proven abilities to actually diversify that risk as well.
Hi, I'm Bronwyn Irwin from IRG Agility, and I'm one of the authors of the Leo paper.
Yep.
So I actually wanted to talk a little bit about diversification of risk, because for me that was one of the more interesting kind of shifts in my thinking. I mean, we all know that diversification of risk, that makes sense as a strategy when you're talking about improving resilience. But I think we often, particularly in the ag sector, as I am an ag economist, we think about diversifying crops. And that's really not sufficient, because if your major risk factor for your community is volatility in rainfall or drought incidences or, you know, some kind of weather pattern, then really what's important is to look beyond agriculture and look at other aspects of income generation. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that came out from this paper that we didn't follow up on in the paper was labor, and really looking at labor markets. So looking at the broader farming system and where are the other opportunities for gaining income, which is an important part of the solution, again, not the only part of the solution. And so I was wondering if you had any examples of working to engage and strengthen access to labor markets or income from labor markets as part of a resilience strategy?
That's a really good point. And we've got a couple of examples, not where we've worked on it, but where we've seen the manifestations. So for example, in Niger, we found a lot of migration of labor because there just wasn't enough work. I would love to see more research in this area, because I also have concerns. There seems to be a lot of emphasis on migration and remittances as a way of diversifying income, and I'm not sure that that's always necessarily a good thing. And there's, you know, if you want to talk about resilience of households and communities, migration for labor has all sorts of influences. So I think the whole issue of labor and labor markets is a really important one that we need to understand more, and there are probably offsetting influences there in terms of diversifying localized risk versus other impacts on people's resilience.
I don't have an answer, and I don't know how much John's got his hand. John's our researcher, so we'll see that.
I'll add a few bits of evidence that we're aware of. So, I mean, there's a number of studies that look at the types of diversification that you mean within an ag sector or some kind of farm-based sector. That really, especially in some of the bigger shocks, don't seem to stand up. It's not spreading risk across enough different profiles to be helpful. So we've kind of gone further and tried to look at independence of income sources. And so in the Philippines, for example, looking at the typhoon and looking at determinants of resilience there, tried to explore that question. Interestingly, I think this gets a little bit to the labor side, which is from what we're seeing, it doesn't require having multiple income sources that are independent prior to a shock, but being able to have access to, in the case of the Philippines, an off-farm job in a local factory to be able to recover was certainly a predictor of greater, at least, resilience there. So I think there's some nuances in terms of both thresholds of the magnitude of a shock, above which no amount of diversification is really going to help, and then thinking about is it, something you're doing before to spread risk proactively or something that you can rely on afterwards.
Morning. I'm Ryan Smeens with Food for the Hungry. Thank you very much for putting these ideas out there and engaging these questions. Kind of an internal question for you guys as Mercy Corps. I really appreciated the clarity of the resilience thinking process framework. It shows real evidence of discipline thinking. And I just wanted to know, for you guys, what are you doing internally to align concepts around the globe, around your country offices? That's a real struggle, I think, and potential something of real importance. So there's probably people online too that might be able to answer some of those stuff.
I like how you think it looks disciplined.
Yeah,
it's a whole lot of chaos.
If only you saw the last 2 to 3 years.
There have been an awful lot of conversations grappling with first what do we mean, and then testing things in the field. And so the fact that it now looks clear is a huge achievement. Yeah, graphics help. I know one thing is certainly we put a priority on this a couple years ago and put resources into having point people focusing on it. We've got regional point people now who are collecting evidence from the field and working back out, so that's part of it. But I would say it's still an ongoing process.
I would just add to that. I think Sasha's right in that making it an institutional priority that was decided at a very senior level that we were going to invest in, not just for a short period of time, but for a longer period was key. And so in doing that, we not only set up how different individuals like myself and Sasha, who sit on different teams within our technical support unit, are going to come together and work together, but also how we're going to work together on a regular basis with people actually doing the work on the ground in the field. And that we set up regional resilience hubs with resilience advisors based in those places. So they're in charge of actually helping to mainstream resilience thinking, resilience concepts in those places. So as we're working with these fuzzy concepts of these different types of capacities and talking about shocks and stresses and systems approaches, they ground us in terms of what that actually looks like on the ground. They work with us to define those concepts. They put them into practice with us, and then we feedback, oh, that was good. This makes no sense. It made sense when you read it in the paper and you're trying to operationalize it, but in reality it doesn't work. So really bringing multiple people who kind of come to the table with a different perspective was absolutely key.
The other thing I would say is the agency put a real commitment into deepening our systems approaches across the board, and we've got a lot of field staff who've been trained in systems approaches and who are implementing at the ground level and experimenting in really innovative ways. And that's a lot of this has bubbled up from what our field teams are doing because of their personal commitment to systems approaches.
Then I would just add one final thing, which is that we all got really sick of resilience just being rebranded as something else. And there was a really concerted effort for us. And I'm only mentioning this because you mentioned how the clarity of articulation of how we're using these words and things. But I think it's important to note that we've made a real effort to distinguish how resilience building efforts means that we have to do our work differently, and that it's not just a rebranding of the same approaches. We may do similar things, but we do them now maybe for potentially different reasons or more nuanced reasons. And it's because we went through a process that we showed you there.
So one of those differences that you both just mentioned is taking a systems approach. And there's quite a lot of head nodding online that facilitation and systems is the way to go in this situation. As market experts, I'm sure you all know intuitively what that means. Being outside of that group and speaking to some maybe that share this bewilderment, what can you just clarify when we say a systems approach, what does that actually look like? How is that different than a non-systems approach, either to market development or resilience more broadly?
Yeah, that's a really big question. For me, I guess where I would start is that, example, if we're working in a particular place with a particular set of communities, we'd want to, at the very basis, be able to understand the larger context that they're an integral part of, right? Communities use particular resources, are reliant upon policies and institutions, and are subject to market changes, all of which, and market conditions, all of which are outside of the boundaries of their particular place that they might be living or working or whatever. And so what we quickly realize is that in order to build resilience in these places, we need to understand that context, and not individually, not by doing a markets assessment and an ecological or a climate assessment, but understanding how all of those things kind of come together and fit together. So it's really about understanding the root causes behind some of the situations that Mercy Corps is trying to work with on the ground. Does that get at it, John?
Okay. Hello, my name is Buen Lazarevsky. I just came back from 1 year in Kinshasa. I was working in the U.S. Embassy there. But before that, I was working in South Africa, in the townships of Johannesburg, Pretoria. And one of the things that I noticed is that a lot of these local communities there, especially in the townships or in the outskirts of Kinshasa, the societies there, the local communities, are actually very resilient to change, but on a different level of activity. So I think that maybe it's the theoretical framework was very beautiful. It helped me a lot understanding the process in a systemic way. But maybe we can learn a lot from their resilience, because I think that maybe it's only my observation that a person from the developed Western countries is not as resilient as some of the people there that have these tectonic changes on everyday life. So yeah, just a little suggestion from my side. Thank you.
That's a very good point, and I absolutely agree with you. And I think all of this work has to be grounded in the capacities already of the population and the stakeholders and how we can build on those. I think one of the sort of meta challenges we're dealing with in the work we do is that you have populations who have great coping strategies and are very resilient, but now they're being faced with shifts, especially in terms of climate and other global issues that are beyond their capacity. And so that's, what do we need to do now? How can we help them cope in this environment that's beyond anything they can deal with, possibly beyond what we can deal with?
So I just had a question that goes back to the issue, the concepts of diversification of livelihoods and risk issues. And I just wanted to know how financial services links into this, because obviously savings and insurance are massive instruments of hedging against that, and I want to know how you think about that.
I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think financial services is a really vital issue here, because I think it's a crucial tool, and right, issues of savings, investment, insurance are really important tools for resilience. I hear, generally in discussions, I hear either them ignored entirely or seen as a resilience strategy, not a tool. And people get confused with insurance is a tool to get you to resilience in and of itself. Insurance doesn't make you resilient. And so I think we need to find the appropriate role for financial services in this. And it taps into the bigger issue that the financial services world is facing, which is behavior change, financial education, the true idea of financial inclusion, which is not just provision of services, but getting people to utilize them in ways that make their lives better, which is a complicated area. But absolutely, financial services is a vital tool to resilience. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so I think we're getting close to time. I want to thank the presenters, Elliot and Sasha, for joining us today for a wonderful presentation. I also want to thank John Kurtz for helping with the webinar facilitation and asking some of the questions that came in online. For any of those who had to leave early or for anyone whose colleagues could not join today, please know that we'll send out an email in about a week with some post-event resources, including a recording of this webinar and the presentation slides. And for anyone who is looking interested in joining our next MicroLink seminar, it's probably very relevant to many of you here. It's related to resilience. So it's going to look at the role of agricultural insurance in an integrated risk management approach to promote resilience and inclusive growth. And it's going to include an example from Senegal from the Rural Resilience Initiative, or R4 project. And that's going to be on April 23rd. Okay?
One additional thing, just because somebody, or it was brought up, but on the question of labor and evidence around labor and what's happening with labor, Leo is wrapping up a new publication that is a stock taking of 300 different publications around labor and pulling it all together, and what does that tell us. So you will be able to find that on MicroLinks probably in the next couple of weeks.
So thank you again to everyone joining us today, both online and in person. We appreciate it.